This episode of the Majority Report is brought to you by the civic engagement podcast, Future Hindsight. Join host Mila Atmos this week as she talks to Mark Rank, a poverty expert and the author of Poorly Understood: What America Gets Wrong About Poverty. Listen in to learn how American poverty is like a game of musical chairs and to understand the systemic factors keeping Americans poor. Available wherever you are, you get your podcasts at available wherever you get your podcasts or at futurehindsight.com.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, May 28th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, New Republic writer, host of The Politics of Everything, Alex Perrine will be joining us to look back in the week in news. Also, later in the program, Matthew Film Guy will be here to give us an analysis. Jeff Bezos's 12 Rules for Fiction or Drama or Narrative. But meanwhile, Mitch McConnell is insisting his Republican caucus kill the January 6th bipartisan commission. 10 states hit the 70% COVID-19 vaccination goal. 40 more to go. White House Democratic states press pan the Republican infrastructure counteroffer. Feds are investigating whether Ukraine fed election misinfo through Rudy Giuliani. Report says U.S. has extensive unexamined intel on the COVID origins. Meanwhile, in Idaho, the lieutenant governor signs a ban on mask mandates while the actual governor was out of state. White House announces it will not rejoin the Open Skies Pact with Russia following Donald Trump's lead. New poll, QAnon now as popular as some major religions in this country. New York City Council votes for a dramatic increase in housing ventures. Could subsidize up to 72,000 apartments for the unhoused. Lastly, a new study, black boys, regardless of economic class, learn less than similarly situated white boys when they grow up and become adults. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Usually at this time, I say hello to Emma Vigeland, ask her how she's doing. But today I will answer for her, not well. She is not feeling well, and so she is not with us today. She always makes it seem like it's a, you know, a ridiculous question to ask. But, you know, here's a perfect example of why it's not such a ridiculous question. Today, she's not feeling good. And so ungood that she's not here. But every reason to believe that she will be back after the long weekend. which we should tell you that we will be taking a long weekend here. But we will be back with a new live show on Tuesday. The big news overnight, there was a, what many presumed was a bipartisan bill regarding China that the Senate had hoped to finish discussing and voting on sometime yesterday and or, you know, the afternoon into the evening. And then they were awaiting the vote where Republicans would filibuster the bill to create a bipartisan commission on what took place on January 6th. This really should have been a completely non-controversial vote. Kevin McCarthy had asked for certain things several months ago for this commission, that it's completely bipartisan. In other words, same amount of Republicans, same amount of Democrats, that Republicans have the same ability to subpoena witnesses as the Democrats do. I mean, they would be effectively just as much in charge of this committee as the Democrats. Virtually the exact same amount of power. The Democrats agreed to that. They brought up the bill. Kevin McCarthy voted against it instead, despite the fact that it had everything he asked for. Mitch McConnell, you'll recall, on January 6th or 7th was saying, you know, this is the responsibility of the president. This is outrageous. It's egregious. And now he's saying, eh, we don't need it. We know everything we need to know. The questions of whether there were people who are lawmakers who had helped people who attended that rally get into the Capitol, apparently not an issue. We heard that congressman the other day who said, you know, the idea that Donald Trump incited this is ridiculous. I was in a hotel and I heard people in the morning before the rally talking about storming the Capitol. Oh, what? So there was clearly a concerted plan by somebody to storm the Capitol. Marcy Wheeler pointed out in a post today, maybe it was yesterday, that the Oath Keepers had sent up a bus to this rally. Oath Keepers are a, some would describe as a militant, sort of, I guess, Christian theocratic organization. They brought up a bus and they, I don't know how else to describe it, seem to have deployed people from that bus in various locations around Washington, D.C. Odd thing to do if they're all just going to a rally. Anyways, these are just questions that I think, like, you know, one would be somewhat interested in answering. Or how was it, like, you know, what was the actual timeline of the response by the Defense Department, the response by the Capitol Police? Let's get some White House officials in to find out what they said. So all of this is being ignored. And this is going to have, it is something that there's no doubt that Congress should examine. I mean, this is, it goes without saying. I mean, it's just such an obvious thing. But this could have real implications in terms of our politics when it comes to passing any other legislation for the rest of the Biden term. And we will talk to Alex Perine about that. But with that backdrop, where the country is still in the wake of the closest thing to an insurrection that we have seen in, you know, 100 years. I mean, there was an attempt, I think, or at least talk of a coup against FDR at one point. But at least in 100 years or so, this is, and maybe even more dramatic since the Civil War. And yet, how are the Republicans responding? Well, here is Matt Gaetz at a rally just yesterday. See if you can pick out anything that might be somewhat inciting in this speech he's giving.
All the fake news media. The Second Amendment is not about, it's not about hunting. It's not about recreation. It's not about sports. The Second Amendment is about maintaining within the citizenry the ability to maintain an armed rebellion against the government if that becomes necessary. I hope it never does, but it sure is important to recognize the founding principles of this nation and to make sure that they are fully understood.
Hmm. Interesting timing. Play the other clip of him, too, at that speech. Because he went, he's got a lot of targets.
The internet's hall monitors out in Silicon Valley, they think they can suppress us, discourage us. Maybe if you're just a little less patriotic, maybe if you just conform to their way of thinking a little more, that you'll be allowed to participate in the digital world. Well, you know what? Silicon Valley can't cancel this movement. Or this rally, or this congressman. We have a Second Amendment in this country, and I think we have an obligation to use it.
I thought the Second Amendment was about the government tyranny, but now he's just sort of expressing it as like, well, oh, you also get the opportunity to carry the weapons. And, you know, if big tech is the issue, then big tech's the issue. This is also incidentally coming after a series of mass shootings that we've had in this country over the past. Well, we had one this week. We had one a couple of weeks ago. And I also do appreciate Matt Gaetz is. No matter who he's with, he likes to tie them in. He tried to do this with Tucker Carlson, too. Remember, we went out to dinner with those women, remember? And there he is up there. Big tech will not cancel any of you or me. We're all in this together. We all maybe allegedly had sex with someone who was under the age of consent. We all may be guilty of statutory rape. That's sort of the Gaetz trick there.
But meanwhile, I like this mantle that talks about political outsiders. He's the son of his grandfather died in North Dakota on stage at a GOP convention. He comes from that long line of a political family.
Yeah. No. This is. I mean, it's the and Donald Trump is not part of the elite in this country. He's part of the billionaire club or that is like, you know, shunned because some people don't like him and some people are rude to him on TV. That's the game that they're playing. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Alex Perine. This is too bad. Emma's not here because she really likes it when I have to read the Hello Tushy ads. Well, let me start with this one first. As you know, dinner time can be chaotic. It certainly is in my household. But with Freshly, it's easy. Freshly's chefs take care of your meals a few nights a week, and they take the pressure off of you, particularly if you have. Bottom line, I imagine, you know, I can't imagine really doing anything that doesn't involve having children around at one point. But it'd be also, you know, I guess even if you didn't have children, this would be make things much easier and still just as delicious. Freshly offers chef-made, nutrient-packed, delicious meals delivered fresh to your door. No cooking required. Freshly, your meals arrive cooked and fresh every week so you can keep your fridge stocked. Skip the trip to the store. Super easy to order. You visit Freshly.com. You choose over 30 meals like steak peppercorn, which happens to be my mother's favorite. I will tell that story in a minute. sausage baked penne, or their chicken pesto bowl. Freshly can fit your lifestyle with a variety of plans and meals to pick up from that you get to pick from that work for whatever your needs are. And now for our listeners, you can try Freshly for just $6.16 per meal. Your meals are ready to heat and enjoy in just 3 minutes. I've told this story before. A couple of years ago, my sisters and I had decided that my mom, we were a little bit concerned that she wasn't eating enough, eating properly, and she wasn't, her cooking skills have diminished a little bit. I don't want to get too explicit about that. But and so what we did is we ordered her Freshly, but we knew that she wouldn't want us paying for her meals. So we told a little white lie that they were advertising on the show and they had given me a lifetime of free meals. And I was giving them to my mom and she loves it. And for a couple of years, she would, every time we would talk, she would talk about how much she loved Freshly, particularly the steak peppercorn. That has always been her favorite meal. And then they showed up and became advertisers for the show. And then I told this story and my mom found out. And so, Mom, if you're listening, you've already heard this story. I think we can all agree that it was a tiny little white lie that we're all happy about. And in the end, they ended up advertising with us just by coincidence. So right now, Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders when you go to freshly.com/majority. Stop stressing about dinner. Go to freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. That's freshly.com/majority for $40 off your first two orders. So I won't be reading this Hello Tushy copy as written because my mom could be listening and she doesn't want to I'm not going to say that in front of my mom. But I can tell you that this is, ladies and gentlemen, and this is the safe for mom version. It is time to clean your butthole. Yes, there's no better way to get your tush in gear than with a Hello Tushy bidet. Hello Tushy's brand new 3.0 modern bidet attachment is here. It's stylish. It's eco-friendly. It's easy to install. It even saves you cheap ass money. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself with a smart spray automatic nozzle. It attaches to your existing toilet. No electricity or extra plumbing needed. Cutting toilet paper use by 80%, paying for itself in a few months. Plus, Hello Tushy has your ass covered with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. You can join millions of happy Hello Tushy customers right now and clean your butt with every flush. Honestly, folks, the Hello Tushy is, I would say, one of the top one or two things that we advertise on this show that we get the emails about where people are like, it's changed my life. Thank you. Never would have done it. Never would have even tried it. Never would have contemplated. Go. You will be surprised at A, how inexpensive this is. B, how easy it is to hook up. Go to hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off plus free shipping. This is a special offer for Majority Report listeners. Go to hellotushy.com/majority for 10% off. hellotushy.com/majority. Okay. Do we have, Alex Perrine? I believe we do. Ladies and gentlemen, staff writer for the New Republic, co-host of the Politics of Everything, Alex Perrine. Alex, I see you've gotten a haircut. Welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Congratulations on the haircut. Emma is out sick today. So it's just us. And Man, what a crazy week. All right, let's just do this at 30,000 feet, and so that we can, because I think a lot of these things tie in quite a bit. At the beginning of the week, we had a judge who was intimately involved in the prosecution of Manafort. I mean, she obviously heard the case, Paul Manafort, and the Mueller investigation writ large. Over the course of the week, and through a FOIA request, there was it became clear that there is the OLC memo that Bill Barr claimed he relied on to make a decision not to prosecute Donald Trump was in fact written in conjunction with Bill Barr. And you know, that is basically like me meeting with my advisors saying, I want you guys to tell me that I should keep doing what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And then going out and telling the public, like, I'm doing what I'm doing because my advisors have told me to do that.
Yeah.
But it's a little bit more egregious when it comes to the DOJ. We also know that Manafort apparently gave information knowingly to someone he knew was going to pass it on to the Russian government, campaign information. And, that is contrary to what we were led to believe, to the extent that, you know, I don't know what constitutes collusion in a legal sense. It's not a legal doctrine, but certainly, you know, they wanted to give those documents to the Russians for some reasons. I mean, it wasn't just like, we got an office pool, you know, I don't know. And then we have McConnell virulently, like supposedly making a personal appeal to quash the January 6th commission.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all sort of like a litmus test, or could be, as to whether there are negotiating partners across the aisle for reticent Democrats
mm-hmm.
who don't want to so-called ruin the government.
Right.
So let's just start with this clip of Joe Manchin yesterday. We have talked more about Joe Manchin, you and I, over the past like 4 or 5 months than I think people have talked about Joe Manchin, period, in his prior time in the Senate.
Right.
Let's play this clip.
Would you be willing to break the filibuster in order to get this passed? The plan
I'm not ready to destroy our government. I'm not ready to destroy our government. No, I think the base will come together. You have to have faith. There's 10 good people.
How frustrating is it for you to see Republicans line up in opposition?
It's frustrating to say this, I will tell you. There was a lot of negotiations, and the leadership of the Democrats on both the House and the Senate have agreed to the recommendations that were made to make the adjustments. There's no excuse for a Republican not to vote for this unless they don't want to hear the truth.
What's your message to Republican senators who are still opposing it, even after meeting with the family today?
Let the truth will set you free. Exactly what I've said. The truth will set you free. If not, then you must be concerned that you have still the fear. I don't know why you would, anyone would want to know what went on for the first time in the history of our country, an insurrection that's never ever happened before, and now being afraid to find out what really happened and how we prevent from ever happening again.
And I should tell you, it is Wall Street Journal reporter. So far, 6 Republicans are breaking with Trump and McConnell to vote in favor of establishing the commission. A distressed Manchin. As the commission appears headed for the defeat in Senate, I'm very disappointed, very frustrated that the politics has trumped literally and figuratively the good of the country. The Republican New York Times reports the Republicans blocked the commission 54 to 35. 11 skipped town so that they wouldn't vote against it. But
it should, like, just, I was just reading the Politico piece on the vote failing. And like, I do feel like, you know, most of the people reading this are probably pretty savvy and understand this. But when we say it failed in a 54 to 35 vote, the 35 won. the side with 35 won the vote and the side with 54 lost. And that, and so 35 people won this vote in the Senate.
And I mean, and also, I mean, just this always, people should always keep this in mind too, that those 35 represent far less than the any 35 you pick from the side that voted for it, because they're from smaller states. And the Republicans represent something like, I don't know, 40 million less Americans in the Senate than the Democrats do. All right. So here is, I mean, here's the question, right? The question is this the thing that ultimately becomes Joe Manchin's leverage point? I saw Axios reported that Joe Manchin said, I'm not going to destroy the government or whatever it was.
Yeah.
But in fact, that's not what he said. He said, I'm not ready to, in that quote. Now, maybe I'm parsing words here a little bit, but I mean, and here's the thing. If Joe Manchin believes that they're hiding something, right? That they're afraid of something because they're hiding something. How does this guy think that he's going to, like, you know, like, why is he, you know, why is this regular order at this point? You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. This should be, and like I say this, like, they gave the Republicans everything they could have possibly wanted in drawing up what this commission would look like. And I think, like, the biggest win for the Republicans would have been to cave on this in order to preserve the filibuster and then appoint whatever lunatics they wanted to this commission. Like, that strategically, if I was Mitch McConnell, that's what I would have done. Now, I think he made a bet that he can do this and that that still won't change Joe Manchin's mind. But at this point, like, this is an insane way to do anything that, you know, it illustrates how little effort you have to put in to block anything that 10 senators can go home, 6 senators can cross the aisle, and this is still the result because of the, like, filibuster via email. You know, it's like, it's nuts.
It's nuts. And so what, let's just isolate some of the players here. What is Mitch McConnell thinking? I mean, the reason why I when, you know, we started this, I raised the point of the, oh, and I should say, I should have added to that array of legal stuff. Obviously, it was announced that there's a grand jury that has been convened to look into Trump Inc. Give me your theory about Mitch McConnell, because I think it has to do with those three developments at the beginning of this week. I think the potential for legal jeopardy for Donald Trump is why he was so worried about a commission that, even though he could have put on the lunatics on that commission, I don't think he wants that in play if this stuff comes down about Trump.
Yeah. And I think that has something to do with it, because, as I said, like, they bent over backwards to make this commission bipartisan and give Republicans power in it. But when you look at the Joint Commission on the Financial Crisis, like, even though the Republicans tried to sabotage that, the Democrats still put out a report, and a pretty good report, because they had the power to actually do the investigation. So to some extent, he thinks, like, even if we put a bunch of people on this to wreck this commission, like, it will still have the power to do investigations, and a report will still come out of it at the end. And, you know, I think you might be right that's simply the thing he doesn't want.
And we should say, you know, there was an interesting piece in the Washington Post about a study done by, and the outfit escapes me. It was a Way to Win.
Oh, yeah.
And they found that the Democrats, you know, there's a lot of theories as to why the Democrats underperformed in the election. And there was a piece in the Cook Report that said, you know, this story about the socialism and this and that, that's not that narrative. No, Democrats basically performed as well as Joe Biden did in most districts. And it was the Republicans who outperformed Donald Trump
Yeah.
And if you combine that with what Way to Win said, which was that they spent, that Republicans spent their time trying to demonize Democrats, and Democrats spent their time trying to say that they'll be bipartisan.
Yeah. Yeah. Democrats their campaigns were on kitchen table issues, and we will be bipartisan.
Right. And you heard, you had Joe Biden, Nancy Pelosi going out there. We need Republicans.
Yeah.
And they're going to return. And I remind everybody, Joe Biden, do you remember the time frame he said? Give him 6 months after Donald Trump's out of office. Mm-hmm. Well, I got some bad news for Joe Biden.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is the Democrats did a very bad job of painting Republicans as extremists.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't, because they were saying, we're going to be bipartisan. Well, why would you? I mean, this is the Joe Manchin dilemma.
Yep.
Why would you try and strike a deal with people who you think are hiding the fact that they were involved in an insurrection?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's cognitive dissonance, like they can't even, people like that can't even give you a coherent answer. The facts are right there in front of his face. Like, I think it's absurd to it. Like, I'm surprised they got six votes. I'm surprised they got six Republicans. But the idea of getting 10 for anything should at this point just be a completely absurd idea.
It should be a totally absurd idea. There shouldn't be anybody in the media who is not hounding anybody who deals with that premise. I mean, to think that you're going to get 10 votes in the Senate for anything of substance, anything on Biden's agenda, is like, we're at like QAnon level like delusion, right? I mean, and I think McConnell wanted to avoid having the commission operating where he could put lunatics on there, or he could put people to hold Trump to account. If he puts people who are going to hold Trump to account, McConnell's terrified for what the outcome is. Mm-hmm. But he also realizes that they need to have the flexibility to distance themselves in 2022 from Donald Trump, at least somewhat. And that's much harder to do if you've got whatever it is, 10 lunatics on a commission talking about how, running interference for Donald Trump. Or if, like you say, if you've got 10 Democrats who are coming out and saying like Donald Trump was involved in this, and so weren't like a couple of key players, you better denounce this guy.
Yeah. 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 And it's also like denying the existence of the commission is also like a way to make sure that or a way to try to make sure that people aren't talking about this whenever this commission, like a few years from now, like a way to try to memory hole the whole thing and like not have it suddenly pop up back in the news cycle for some reason whenever this commission makes news or issues a report down the line.
And now I think Democrats could theoretically, and I think they should, they could form their own.
This is the funniest part, is that they're fighting. They're like the Democrats have made a huge, huge political fight over the need to establish a bipartisan commission. And the Democrats in the Senate are begging their Republican colleagues to give them bipartisan cover to do something bipartisan. And now that that has failed, like if they want to investigate January 6th, they have to do it in a partisan way. They have to actually hold hearings. They have to actually empanel like their own special committee or something like that. I think Claire McCaskill tweeted like yesterday, like they held however many hearings on Benghazi. And it's like they did. They did not empanel a bipartisan commission to study Benghazi. They just kept holding hearings.
And they also didn't need any Republicans to say, hey, the Democrats held so and so many, like, just do it.
Just do it.
You don't need to say like, well, we have a Benghazi license to do this. Just do it.
Just do it.
But they really want to make a show of this. And here is, let's play this clip of Joe Biden, because I got to think that if I'm Joe Biden, I'm pretty happy about this outcome. Mm. Let's play this clip.
I can't imagine anyone voting against the establishment of a commission on the greatest assault since the Civil War on the Capitol. But at any rate, hey guys, I can't for ice cream.
That's right.
I'm sorry. I got really strong now watch this drive vibes from that clip.
Yeah, exactly. but I think that, like, you know, Biden's got to be sitting there, right? I mean, Biden's whole agenda, it seems to me, relies on convincing Joe Manchin to vote to kill the filibuster, or, you know, whatever, to amend it in some fashion. And, it, you know, I mean, I know that Joe Biden's the president, and it's his responsibility to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But I, you know, he may have some leverage with Joe Manchin, but I don't think he has as much as, like, you know, Barack Obama did over Joe Lieberman. Right. Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, he's in a 60% Trump state.
Yeah.
And, like, I think, you know, the thing that Biden could do to help Joe Manchin is to broker some deal where they convince AOC to protest Joe Manchin's office. I mean, that's what Joe Manchin wants, right?
Like, yeah,
Joe
exactly,
Manchin
yeah.
wants to be able to, like, say,
we'll,
like,
send, yeah, we'll, yeah, we'll send, we'll send AOC over to, like, make you, right, to make
yeah,
you
on
look
some
like
other
a good
issue.
Conservative.
You pick the issue and
yeah,
we'll,
and we'll she'll, see. Yeah, right, exactly. And then you get to stand up against the left.
Right.
And then, I mean, this is like, if they were savvy about this, that would be the strategy behind this. If so, and I think to some extent, people in the White House and maybe Biden do see this as, they needed to get permission to alter the filibuster. And the way to get permission to alter the filibuster is to show how broken the Senate is. And here right. it is. Here's how broken the Senate is. So that's the savvy way to get about this, like, to get yourself permission among moderates and in the political press to do so, to change the filibuster. And then you say, well, look how we can't even get a bipartisan commission on the insurrection. Can't even do that. So, like, something has to change. And so now we see, like, okay, like, is that the strategy and is it going to work? Because there's a million, we've talked about this, I think, every time I've been on the show this last year.
It's
there's
the
a million
whole
different,
story.
Yeah.
It's the whole story.
There's a million different things you can do that would allow Joe Manchin to say, well, we kept the filibuster in place, but while actually, like, changing it so that the Senate can pass anything, you know? Like, right now, the filibuster is just too easy. It's too, like, you know, Republicans don't have
35. They had a filibuster. They were able to stop this bill with 35. Never mind 40. They stopped it with 35 people.
Yeah. And, you know, and the implicit filibuster is stopping everything else. Right. Like, and, you know, we know now that, like, you filibuster something by sending an email and then it's, like, officially filibustered. You don't have to do anything. And, like, that, the least they could do is make it a little harder for their opponents. And I think that, like, it still seems like that's the easiest way forward. And it's a question of whether Manchin feels like he's able to sell that to himself or to his state.
I mean, how much, if I'm Joe Biden and that is my strategy, like, we need something that is completely a slam dunk, a bipartisan commission on a thing that where they were calling for the hanging of Donald Trump's of the Republican vice president.
Yeah.
Right. Like, can we get a bipartisan thing on that? OK. And then if we don't get it, let's try and make the vote so twisted that 35 people outvoted 54 people.
Yes.
Right. Like, this is like what, if you were going to sit there and say, we need to genetically engineer this, this is what it would look like.
Yeah.
This would be like,
you have now the perfect pretext to blow up the filibuster. Like, this is, you know, you gave yourself a 6-month time frame to see if the Republicans would break their fever. Here we are. It's just about June. And this is the 54 to 35 vote.
I mean, if I'm Biden right now, I go on television. I do a primetime press conference.
Yeah.
And I say I've been in, you know, I use the full force of my old age and say, you know, I've been in this Senate for 50 years and I never, ever, ever imagined a situation where the, you know, something like this would be filibustered.
Yes.
35 votes. It is with the heaviest of hearts that I say the Senate is broken.
Mm-hmm.
And it breaks my heart because I'm a Senate man.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever. And just just have like all of this weight just come on Joe Manchin, where it's like, he's the one guy who's standing in the way of like, he's the one guy who still thinks the Senate works.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That seems to me to be like, that's the full court press. It's just a question of like, how pissy is Joe Manchin? And will he like be like, I don't appreciate being pressured this way?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, that's, I think that would be like, if Biden did that, obviously Biden's not going to say, and Joe Manchin, like, you change your mind. No, but yeah, I do. But if you just, if he just went on, exactly. If he went on TV and just repeat it, 35 votes to, you know, they're like, I think that that would be like, and this is this. We have become so used to the era of McConnell that like the news doesn't actually make it clear how screwed up these votes are, you know, like they just say Republicans block it.
Yep. I mean, it is, it's crazy. And, you know, to be honest, like, I mean, I think it's, you know, perfectly reasonable to have a commission on January 6th, but I'm just more interested in the infrastructure bill, and I'm interested in, in the PRO Act and S1. And so let's just, you know, pivot a little bit to that to just get a sense of what has been, what is, you know, what's happening with that. Joe Biden started off with a $2.3 trillion bill.
Mm-hmm.
And Shelley Moore Capito came out and said, well, we're thinking like $600 to $700 to $800 billion. And she was asked why that number. And she goes, I don't know. It's just it sounds reasonable. And I'm not joking that she actually said that. And so they go into negotiations. Biden drops down to $1.7 trillion, then signals he's willing to drop down to $1 trillion.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans come back with a $950 billion bill, with which only $250 billion is actually new monies.
Yeah.
Some of it they're going to take from states, they're claiming, although there's a story today that like 12 state treasurers or comptrollers basically contacted the White House and said, we've earmarked that money. Like, you haven't given it to us yet.
My God. Yeah. Yeah.
We've already spent it. Like, you know, that's not you know how this works.
This is going to be the craziest part of our era, is that like, having in a crisis sort of returned to doing important and good things, this period when it's like people want to claw them back, like the increased state and local aid. Like, I don't know how many people have seen the chart, but like that was huge. It started going down under Reagan, never recovered. So yes, it's a good idea to give the state and local governments more money. Like, the federal government should be in the habit of doing that. And
it should
the
be
idea
regular,
like now,
yes.
Like, oh, that, well, now it turns out the states are doing fine, so let's claw that money back. Like, no, that's absurd.
It's absurd. It's absolutely absurd. And I don't think they're going to do it.
I don't think so, but yeah.
Jen Psaki came out, I guess, yesterday and said, this infrastructure thing is inadequate. So what happens now? I mean, is it your sense? Have you talked to folks on the Hill that they are, you know, I saw something, I guess it was a week ago, a little bit more than a week ago. Schumer et al. Were meeting with a parliamentarian. Like, I mean, when do we get the parliamentarian fired?
Yeah.
And then we just go ahead with this stuff.
Yeah. I don't know. My sense is that as long as the White House is doing this negotiating with the Republicans, the Senate can't move, right? Because this negotiation is happening, and the White House is now that makes them in charge of like where the direction this thing takes. I don't particularly understand. Like, I don't understand. I don't know. I think that there's like leadership seems sort of not worried enough about the whole thing getting derailed in the sense of like, if they strip out all the good bits so that they can negotiate a deal with Republicans, like, do they really think they're going to get like, they're going to get all those good bits later on and like get 50 Democrats plus the vice president to pass only the good bits, you know, like
that's what they are sort of floating a little bit. But I mean, that's the thing, is it's so hard to tell what is actually going on.
Yeah.
You know, like I've always been my sense with these things that what we're really seeing is our shadows of the actual activity that's happening, you know, and though they get distorted. There, it's a distorted image of what is actually going on there. But if they are moving on to reconciliation, I think originally the deadline was this week was Memorial Day.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've pushed it another week. And then it seems to me that like you have this period of time between now and the end of July when you have the debt ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And there's another opportunity for the filibuster reform right there.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to work backwards from there. Like the reconciliation would take you probably to mid July.
Yeah.
And then maybe you get rid of the filibuster because of the debt ceiling. Or maybe it happens before then. I mean, it feels like this infrastructure bill is A-okay in terms of reconciliation.
Yeah.
Or we haven't, I mean, it's just interesting to me that we haven't heard anything about that, right? Because, I mean, this is around the time where we would hear the parliamentarian thinks that blankety blank doesn't fit in the reconciliation, if that was the case, right? That, I mean, I'm just going back to like when we got the $15 minimum wage and we heard that that was problematic maybe early on. And I don't hear anything like that about like the $400 billion worth of elder care or anything like that. And
yeah.
So that strikes me as they are moving forward and they're just keeping their powder dry.
Yeah. I mean, I think I was trying to find, I was just reading something about reconciliation and whether, and like, I think that like, this would fall under it, right? Like it would be pretty classic, like example of the sort of thing you would use reconciliation to pass. So, and you know, House Democrats sort of think that they're just going to go through with that after exhausting these negotiations. But you know, I do think like, I think the calendar is beginning to work against them if they want to do more than two things this year. And I don't know. I mean, we saw that story about Joe Biden, like taking a long time to make decisions. Right. And I think that there's some truth to that. And I think it also explains why everything has been taking so long to get done and for a strategy to be decided on, you know, like what are we moving forward with first? Are we doing infrastructure first? Are we doing elections first? Well, for a while, it was like the next priority is elections. And now we've moved on to like, all right, the big thing to get done is infrastructure. So I think that there's like, I think like to one extent we can't know the strategy, and also it might be unsettled and changing depending on what the president hearing, who he hears from, and whether or not, you know, he's made up his mind yet.
Ryan Grimm wrote a piece based upon a conversation he had with Adam Gentleson. Gentleson was the former Harry Reid, staffer who wrote the book about the Senate. We had him on this program, I guess, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago. And he is one of the people who've been really pushing for filibuster reform. And according to Gentleson, there's like, it's a three-act play. The first act is just laying out the case, getting it into the bloodstream, sort of making it, you know, the idea of like the possibility of it happening and et cetera, et cetera. The second act, I think, according to Gentleson, has just happened.
Mm-hmm.
Like we literally, that vote today was the second act where it was sort of, there is indisputable proof that the Senate is broken, that the filibuster no longer works and is being abused. And it is so obvious that everyone needs to respond to it. And act three is the negotiation on what reform you make.
Yeah.
And I sort of feel like we already went through act three, mm-hmm. right? The first time that Manchin came out and said talking filibuster.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Which was a revolutionary change. Yeah.
And Dianne Feinstein said she was for it. Now, apparently she's forgotten that she said that she was for it. Did you see that?
Yeah, I saw that. She not only has she forgotten that she was for it, she also is like, who's been talking about the filibuster? She was like, who's been talking about changing that? It hasn't come up.
I mean, Can we just talk about Dianne Feinstein for a moment?
Yeah.
How does anyone call themselves a Senate institutionalist and not work to get people who are clearly, clearly suffering cognitively? And I'm sensitive to this.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, this is not, this is something that, you know, I am very sensitive to this. In my personal life, the idea that there aren't people who are saying like, we've got a major problem here. Like she can't, you know, she doesn't remember what position she took a month ago.
Yeah.
And she's not aware that there's talk about the filibuster. I mean, every single person who is even remotely engaged with politics understands that is the linchpin of everything.
And you know, I mean, my God, you don't have a large majority. You it's a 50-50 Senate.
Yeah.
Like every single Democratic senator, it's essential that you have their vote and that you have some faith in their basic capacity to do their job.
Right. Like, I mean, what happens if she is incapacitated? She can't, she's not going to step down, but she's incapacitated for a period of time. Like if anybody thinks that one day without any advance planning, without anybody pushing her out, frankly, that it's just going to be like, oh, we're going to do this cleanly. And, you know, Newsom will appoint somebody the next day. Like that's not the way it works, right? There's going to be an interim period where she's just not available to vote.
Yeah.
And then it's over.
Yeah. That's yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like the Democratic control of the Senate could be lost in a day.
It could be lost in a day. And it could also be even almost like suspended.
Yeah.
For a period of time.
Exactly.
And I mean, this is like, this is the height of, I mean, this is like Chuck Schumer's job.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, isn't it?
It is. It should be. I mean, that's like, you know, the Senate is different from the House. Like the majority leader in the Senate does not consider himself to be like, he considers the job to be making his members happy, not to be making them do stuff. And I think.
Let's be clear. That's what Chuck Schumer perceives.
That's
the
what
job
Schumer. Is. Yes, exactly. That's how
not
Schumer,
what Mitch McConnell looks like.
No.
In the job.
No.
Chuck Schumer thinks he's a concierge.
Yeah. I think, and you know, I think Schumer's changing, but I also think like for some reason, and we know the history of the Senate, for some reason there is this like bright line against encouraging people who should not be there anymore to retire. It's just, it's, you know, Strom Thurmond stuck around forever. It's just like not, and I find that to be bizarre and damaging to the institution, but it's just like that's part of the history recently, at least now that we've had people have been staying there for so long.
Is it just like, you know, I mean, I know this is not necessarily helpful to get this sort of like psychological, but Patrick Leahy just filed for, you know, that he's going to run for re-election.
Yeah.
Feinstein has filed paperwork for re-election. I, you know, this is one of those things where it's like, I think you got to make the candidate actually do it. No staffers.
Right.
Make the candidate fill it out.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like an eye test. Like it's harder to, you know, get a driver's license than it is to re-up for the Senate. And it's really just seems to me to be a level of narcissism that because, you know, like, I mean, look, celebrities have narcissism. But the implications of that are much less. It's really, you know, they're mad because they didn't get cast in that role and they should have been that role. Everybody knows that's the perfect role for me. Or, you know, I can't believe I didn't get invited to that party.
Right.
But when Patrick Leahy or Dianne Feinstein are narcissists, they're saying like, I'm the only person in the state who can be the senator.
Yeah, exactly. I think I saw a quote that Leahy was like, "Oh, you know, really only I can win this election." Like, or someone close to Leahy was characterized that as his thinking, and it's like that's nuts. That's completely nuts. And with Feinstein too, I think that there's this idea that it's like they're indispensable because of their you know, brilliance and their knowledge of the institution. Even when they start forgetting some of that knowledge of the institution, still this idea is that they're irreplaceable.
All right. So with all that said, what, and you know what, let's just for the heck of it, Stephen Breyer, please retire.
Yes.
But, as you're looking out and you're anticipating the next, I don't know, 2, 4, 6, 8 weeks, right? We're 130 some odd days into Joe Biden's presidency. I think we're still at that same point where it's like you got an incomplete, mm-hmm. but it really is going to be, you know, I said this the other day to Digby, the first 200 is the new first 100 in terms of days. Right. And yeah. like, I mean, that's really what we're going to get a sense.
Yeah.
We're going to know, it seems to me, in 60 or 70 days, whether the Biden presidency is going to have any sort of like meaningful legislation
yeah.
beyond the COVID relief. That was obviously meaningful, but that was like, that got us out of a crisis. I think economically, I think it's going to help the economy going forward, but it doesn't do anything structurally.
Right.
There's no, exactly. There was no real investment in the country, long-term or even midterm investment, it seems to me, in the country that came out of that, that COVID relief. I think it was like, it's going to help people get through this patch. Mm-hmm. But there's no transformative element of that as it sits now. There were things that could be extended, but, you know, the child tax credit for one, but, so what do you think?
Well, I think we're going to know once we know the fate. So what I was waiting for after the COVID relief was like, what's thing number two? Like I just said, they got a pile of things they need to do. It was clear they hadn't decided what thing number two was. And now we've wasted a lot of time getting to thing number two. But that also means we're going to know, depending on whether they pass this and how they pass this. Some version of infrastructure is going to get passed. But we're going to know the version of it that gets passed and how they do it. It's going to tell us a lot about what the future holds. And I think what they do in response to the vote today. So it's the optimistic version is like, all right, we move on to Adam Gentleson's step three now. And like that, then we move towards getting as much done as we can. And we do a good infrastructure bill. We do a good elections bill. And then we do the pro and we do, you know, some version of the PRO Act. And like, that would be ideal. And the only way to do it is like, if this is the day that signals that the filibuster is going to change. Obviously the pessimistic one is like, well, infrastructure, they decide to like, they negotiate with them. They negotiate it down with themselves. Don't get any Republican support, pass it through reconciliation. And then sort of everything gets blocked from there. Like that's a realistic scenario, you know? And I think that there are Democrats in the Senate who would be perfectly comfortable with that because they're comfortable right. with doing the least amount of stuff.
Right. And then we just move on to some sort of like vague notion of engaging in the culture war.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That, you know, around, you know, whether, you know, Donald Trump should have his account suspended on, right. You know, on whatever it is, MySpace or whatever. Now, apropos of the conversation we were just having, Ryan Grimm tweeted 10 minutes ago, Chuck Schumer has sent out a letter to his colleagues. Mm-hmm. Here is the letter. Let's pop this letter up. We got a minute here. Senate Democrats are doing everything we can to move legislation in a bipartisan way when and where the opportunity exists. But we will not wait months and months to pass meaningful legislation that delivers real results for the American people. Looking ahead, the June work period will be extremely challenging. I want to be clear, the next few weeks will be hard and will test our resolve as a Congress and a conference. I got to say, he wrote this very quickly after hearing our conversation.
Yeah, he did. He was like, all right.
When the Senate reconvenes on June 7th, We will seek to pass H.R. 7, the Paycheck Fairness Act, a long overdue piece of legislation previously filibustered by Senate Republicans during President Obama's second term. We will also begin to confirm President Biden's judicial nominees, including Judge Kendenchi Brown Jackson for the highly important U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals of D.C. Circuit. We may also consider gun safety and LGBTQ equality legislation during the June work period. And finally, in the last week of the June work period, the Senate will vote on S1, For the People Act, the legislation that is essential to defending our democracy, reducing the influence of dark money and special interest, and stopping the wave of Republican voter suppression. So I have mixed emotions about that, because it feels like those are all things that those are cannon fodder. That's the chum in the water. That's where they're like hoping to get to the filibuster reform. And that.
I mean, look,
let me take a quick break. Let me take a quick break here for a second, and then we'll come back and just have 1 minute to wrap things up. Be right back. So a last word, Alex.
I hope that this is the last 35 vote winning side Senate vote that I see for a very long time.
If the Democrats do not plaster that dynamic everywhere and anywhere, that is a failure, a complete malfeasance. That is it for our time on Peacock today, folks. We will have a best of on Peacock on Monday for Memorial Day, and we will be back Tuesday live. And then for those of you who are sticking around, Alex, let's wrap this up a little bit. I mean, it looks like to me from that letter that Schumer is basically saying we're going to allow them to filibuster all these different things here.
Yeah. I mean, gun, whatever the merits of gun legislation, that's no way that's passing. And it hasn't even been on Biden's agenda. You know, it's like not even a thing that's been talked about.
That they are. I am disturbed that they are. I mean, if you think about these things like paycheck LGBTQ rights, he said maybe we'll do that. Like, I mean, it really does sound like we're going to put a hodgepodge of bills designed. They don't want them to fail, but they're going to, because there's no filibuster reform. We're going to put them up, and it's going to, this is the stuff that we're hoping to agitate our base.
Yeah.
So they come out and vote.
Yep. And then they're going to see Republicans blocking all of them.
And they're going to see Republicans blocking all of them. But I'm very distressed that they do not see S1 as being, it indicates to me that Manchin has said, I'm not voting for S1 under any circumstances whatsoever. So have that go down in flames. If we get to a post filibuster period of time, I'm in Manchin's voice, I will vote for the John Lewis bill, which doesn't go quite as far. I think they're really worried about the disclosure of the money is really what it is.
Yeah.
But it does do something in terms of protecting voting rights. Very important as well. But I think that's what's going on here. We're going to clear the decks of all the things that we want to make it look like we want to pass, but don't actually want to pass or don't care that much about passing.
Yeah.
We're going to use those as chum maybe to get us to a post filibuster period of time, blame the Republicans for those other things not going, come back with another set of bills that are not sacrificial lambs, as it were.
Yeah.
That's the way I read that. But that's, you know, without.
I mean, we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see. Well, Alex, always a pleasure. Folks always can check out. When does your podcast, when does it release?
Every other Wednesday.
Every other Wednesday.
Yeah.
Really,
we're trying to put out, you know.
Strolling along. It's like a walk in the park. Well, it's post-pandemic. Everybody's trying to shed responsibilities.
Right.
Incidentally, this is my last show ever. Alex Breen, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Folks can check out The Politics of Everything. And if you do not read Alex's pieces in The New Republic, within hours of them being posted, you are missing out on valuable insights. Alex, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam.
All right, folks. And now, as is our tradition on Fridays, we have a guest that is a little bit, you know, often either comedic or entertainment based, and some of whom actually come with their own theme song. Isn't that right, Matt Leck? Right. Okay. All right. I probably should have had it at the ready. See if I could do it. Well, with that said, it can come in later. There's no reason why a theme song has to come in. Look at you, clean shaven, almost Matthew Film Guy. Emma is not here with us today. She's a little sick.
Sounds like she's picking up some of Michael's old bad habits. Maybe it's something in that office.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a little bit of maybe. Interesting.
Interesting
theory. So wait a second. You cut your beard.
Well, I didn't do it. I told you before, I have professionals. I can only trust a professional to do this because otherwise I'll just screw it up. And plus I get yelled at for making a mess in the bathroom. So yeah, you know, what can I say? I'm trying to keep it. You know, honestly, I'll say my class has expanded greatly since we've been discussing it on your show. So I'm taking a little bit more pride in my appearance when I actually have to appear in front of so many people from around the world now on my Zoom classes, including not just one, but two Cedar Sisters.
That's right.
So you just want to make sure.
You have the full Cedar Sister compliment. Now, I
want
to make it clear to everyone. I was joking that this is my last episode. I'm seeing on the IM, people are like saying, wait, is this really your last episode? No, it is not. No, we are.
I was about to be honored to be on your last episode.
Not even remotely close. There's going to be at least another 1,000 episodes of this show.
How many more presidential cycles? That's how you should measure it.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I really don't know. I don't know.
How big of a human container can you expand to be?
I am a massive, massive container. I contain multitudes.
Walt Whitman.
Matt, let's do it.
Sorry, I can't play it. There we are.
Matthew, the film guy, is choosing a straight. Cassavetes on Netflix and other such themes. Maybe I'll watch one and learn a few things. Please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew, please recommend me a movie to stream. Matthew,
Film Guy.
Also just got a comment that little bit telling that you're willing to look like a hobo for your girlfriend, but not for online strangers.
Listen, I'm trying to make a living here, right? So there's commercial implications to my appearance now, as opposed to simply just aesthetic and emotional. But listen, all due respect to Mary, she is a big fan of this look as well. So I'm not saying that's not in the mix.
She likes all your looks.
No, I wouldn't say that. I would not say that. I definitely would not say that. But it's all in the mix. But thank you for implying that it's not. It's I want to just say, Sam, I'm glad you're going to keep doing this show. I love this show. I'm a fan of this show. But it's just a little, it's throwing me off a little bit that you're talking so slowly, because normally I listen to it on 1.75x. So if I'm a little confused, just bear with me.
I believe that our show is probably has the highest percentage of people who speed it up. And that's why I actually am now starting to talk even slower.
That's
so
fine.
So that people even speed it up further. We actually have it hooked up to a blockchain. So the more that people speed up the show, I actually get...
make more Bitcoin?
More Bitcoin.
That's amazing. Well, I'm glad to be helping out in that endeavor.
That would actually be a great system. So, all right, Matthew Film Guy. There's a lot of things I want to talk about. Obviously, your film class is going gangbusters because of the massive platform that we have given you here.
Indeed.
And I have to say, honestly, my sisters rave about your class.
That's nice really to hear. Do. That's really nice to hear. They are amazing members of the class. It's really interesting how it's expanded the reach and the sort of input that comes into the class. And they're a big reason why we've got this really great thing going now. So I appreciate that. And thank you for forwarding that to me. I'll try not to let it go to my head.
I did something that I thought was really interesting last night. I went on Trevor. What's Trevor's last name, Matt, from Champagne Sharks? Trevor Ballou's show. I don't know if it was Champagne Sharks or if it's like a specific different podcast, but it was they're looking at like the white canon of films, and we went on to talk about Reality Bites, and
oh, wow.
I hadn't seen that movie in 30 years. It came out about 28 years ago, maybe. So I hadn't seen it about 28 years. And, you know, I knew Janine at the time. I wasn't,
besties yet.
Yeah, I wasn't besties yet, but I knew her at the time. You know, I ended up a couple years later, you know, knowing Ben Stiller a little bit and Steve Zahn. To watch that movie is fascinating now. It really is fascinating. I mean, one, it's also like, from an era where, oh, everybody's white in the movie. That doesn't occur to me that there's anything even remotely odd about that at all, to like, oh my God, everybody was white in that movie. And I imagine for black people and people of color, they watched that movie and they were very conscious of it. Like, everybody's white in that movie at the time. But I think as a white person, maybe just at that age or just in general in our society, I didn't have that level of sensitivity until a couple of years later, frankly, when I did a half white, half black show and realized like, oh, I never see these guys anymore anywhere, in Hollywood, never run into them in any type of audition or anything. It's a completely segregated world. But I was also struck just generationally, like how there's so much that has changed in gender dynamics, in like, you know, Ethan Hawke ends up, you know, with
What's-Her-Face.
And he was an incredibly abusive guy, like really horrible guy. And, you know, at the time you're like cheering, oh, they got together. But really, no, he was a horrible human being. And Ben Stiller's character is this sort of like yuppie type of guy a little bit, but, you know, sort of nice. Yeah. You know, I mean, I wouldn't want to necessarily be friends with him, but I wouldn't want to be friends with either one of those guys. But it was really interesting to see in the early 90s, if you want, you know, and Matt and Brendan, you guys might appreciate this too. If you want to get a sense of just how devoid of critique of capital, of the language of a critique of capital existed at that time, watch this movie, because the Ethan Hawke character is supposed to be that guy who today would be talking about socialism. He'd be talking about late stage capitalism. He'd be talking about the exploitation of workers. And they don't.
But he's Gen X. He's Gen X. It's the perfect Gen X encapsulation of just like dropout, nihilistic, who gives a shit. Reality just bites. Don't even try to change it. It's that perfect encapsulation of your generation. I mean, I'm late Gen X. That kind of take on the world. I mean, it actually winds up being the product of capitalism, like why they feel this way and why they're alienated. So the meta answer is that explains it. They don't talk about it. There's no attempt to change it or to do anything other than bop around to My Sharona.
Exactly. And part of the problem was, too, is like we're coming out of an era where we disdain the yippies and the
hippies. They were too earnest.
They were too earnest, and they ended up selling out by 93.
Right.
You know, like by the late 80s, Abbie Hoffman's going around, you know, debating his buddy, I can't remember his name now, who had turned into a yuppie. And they were actually doing like a commercial debate. Right.
Pro wrestling event.
A little bit. And so... The Gen X could not commit. The earnestness was impossible because you couldn't rebel against
it. It was something to be skeptical to.
You couldn't rebel against the system, and you didn't want to be part of the system. And that's why everything was so ironic, because I can't, you know, I don't want to be there and I don't want to be here. So I'm going to be stuck somewhere in the middle going back and forth. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to, you know, at the end, the guy's wearing a suit and he's mocking. There's this like undercurrent of mocking Ben Stiller's character because he's in a suit. By the mm-hmm. end, this guy's in a suit, but his suit doesn't fit and it's ill fitting. It's sort of dumpy. It's like, I'll wear a suit, but it's going to be a bad suit. You know, like
right.
Everything has to be ironic. It was just a fascinating. It was I would encourage people to check out the conversation because I learned a lot over the course of the conversation and thought it was interesting.
Yeah. If I don't have enough Sam Cedar in my diet this week, I'll definitely check that out.
Well, it wasn't just me. It was Brandy Jensen and Vita. I don't know if I caught Vita's last name, but she's a part of the Champagne.
I'll Google it.
So check it out.
That sounds good. But what's interesting also as a tag is that, you know, Janine Garofalo then somehow became the voice of political kind of consciousness of her generation. Like she started in this place. You know, I don't know. I don't want to speak to what her personal politics were at the time of. But, you know, the fact that she then became the sort of like the one lone voice in the wilderness of your generation. I mean, you were there, too. But you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
I think that's an interesting footnote to that movie, and I wonder what she thinks about what you just said about that today.
Yeah, I'll ask her about that.
You know, by the way, it's good that you have you need to have me on more, Sam, because you need a mid late Gen Xer like me to fill in the gaps in all your cultural references between you and Matt and Emma. Like, I feel like I know who the unknown comic is. My parents made me watch The Gong Show. I know who Ricky Schroeder is or Murphy Brown. Like, there's like a gap there. So if you need me, I'm here to fill in those middle because, you know, we're about, what are we, like 10 years apart? So I feel like there's this, the show's missing
that
middle.
Are we 10 years apart? I thought you were younger than that. How old are you?
I was born in 1975. Look it up.
Oh, only 9 years.
Huh. Okay, so there you go. It's just the baby face. It fools you.
Fart on the IM says, is there a difference between yuppie and yippie? That is just amazing to me. Yippies were the hippies who were a little bit more political, I think, and a little mm-hmm. bit more subversive, like on purpose. And they, you know, the yippies were the ones who threw the dollars on the floor of the stock exchange. They were much turn on, turn out, and drop out.
They were doing more stuff.
A little political. Yes. Yuppies were young, upwardly mobile.
Upwardly mobile.
People. Yeah.
Right. Those are my parents. My parents were both at Woodstock and then later, you know, voted for Reagan. So like that was their trajectory.
Yep. All right. So with that said, I brought that up only because of the film. But let's talk about something in the
film
news.
Film is good.
Shall
okay,
we?
Okay, sure.
Amazon.
Yes, we shall.
Amazon. There's a couple of things I want to talk about Amazon. One is their purchase of the MGM. Like what? Of the MGM library for billions of dollars, I think it is, right? And
yeah.
For them, though, that's like, oh, chump change. That's like you going out and buying another one of those framed, you know, posters behind you.
Yeah.
And then we can talk about Bezos saying that he knows what it takes to make a great show. This should not be that hard. All these iconic shows have basic things in common. This is just like the dumbest. Like, I don't even need to read the list of those things to know. As someone who has, you know, created a couple of shows and been on, I guess, you know, I did, I don't know, 10, 12 network pilots. Saw, like, you know, a lot of failure, frankly, in show business. I've seen success more from arm's length than really up close. But just the idea that, like, oh, if you have the right elements in a show, then it should work. Off the top of his head, displaying his characteristic ability to shift disciplines multiple times a day, then reduce complex issues down to the most essential. He started to reel off the ingredients of epic storytelling. Here it is. A heroic protagonist who experiences growth and change.
Where did he get that?
From every script writing book that you can buy, like, you know, that is based on the hero's journey. This is like some type of
magic formula.
Right. You've got like seven of those. Right. Is that the guy from Michigan?
Michigan? Sid Field. This was like the one like you have to get this if you're ever going to try to write
the
a
Sid
screenplay.
Field one. And then there was another guy. Oh, maybe that was I'm thinking of a guy who taught. Yeah. Sid Field, and then what's the other one? The Hero's Journey, right? That was based upon Joseph Conrad.
McKee. Yeah.
Oh, McKee is the guy from Michigan.
Yeah, McKee. Yeah, he was big. Adaptation, the movie with Nicolas Cage that they did a whole riff on that. Yeah, The Hero's Journey. Joseph Campbell, I heard. I think Brendan say, yeah.
Here it is.
Keep going. This is a wonderful list.
A heroic protagonist who experiences growth and change. And here it is, a compelling antagonist.
Bingo. Just get a compelling antagonist. There you go.
This is what's so awesome about this is that he thinks the secret is coming up with the words a compelling antagonist, as opposed to like, yeah, no sh.
But the nature
how do you
of
create
that.
A compelling antagonist.
This is the Beavis and Butthead school of like, I like things that are cool. I hate things that suck. You know, like, okay, yeah. You want a compelling attendance. Yeah.
This is business school guys thinking they can become script writers, basically.
Totally.
I mean, some of these have detail. Some of these are not that stupid. Some of these are the formula that are constantly regurgitated and used to basically hook people into watching.
And I want to correct Matt Leck. What Matt Leck just said was you know these are the business guys think they can become script writers. Here's the reality. They can.
They are.
Without a doubt. Because writing a good script, right? One that's gonna sell, not that hard for someone who knows how to sell. Right? Like, I mean, you go in and you There you go.
Because right there. I read it. Got it.
Here's the dirty little secret. The reason why entertainment often sucks is because someone has to walk into a room and sell a bunch of executives who really don't know what they're doing.
Ben Stiller in a suit.
Yeah, who really don't know what they're doing. And anybody who knows how to sell can sell to those people. Like, I mean, I had a lot of success selling scripts, a lot of success. And it was because I could go into a room and sell a script. Like, and I got fairly sophisticated in the way that I would sell these scripts. I would create all sorts of fictional tales that I may have implied were actually not fictional as a way of saying, like, that this is it, because they love that. They love that. Executives love to take real stories. I would sell stuff. I would sell stuff that, like, I would make up a... I sold multiple scripts about stay-at-home dads. Went to HBO. CBS was about to buy it, and then the writer's strike happened. But what I would do is I'd go and I would tell them stories from my life that were all fictionalized. And then I would tell them the script idea. And I had executives who would say to me, like, hey, is there any way we could take that story that happened to you that time and put it in the script? And I'm like, I hadn't thought about that, but that really works. I mean, this is just, it's about sales. It
has nothing to do master with making, of the pitch.
Has nothing to do with making a good show. So many more things go into the making of a good show. It's all the execution. I mean, a script is good. It's a roadmap. More often than not, it's much helpful to have a roadmap. Would you agree with this, Matthew?
Well, yeah, but I also want to just speak on another aspect of this to me, which seems like, I've been saying this for years. Hollywood has figured out a way to make a formulaic product that sells. Half the time, if you are hooked by a trailer or by the commercial for the movie, you'll go see it. They've already got your money. They don't, word of mouth doesn't build a film anymore. It needs to do well within a very short period of time. Stars and a certain kind of bullet point list of things that are on this list that actually, look, it's not a guarantee that it will work, because what you're saying is true. Even the most formulaic movie still has to have the talent and the craftsmanship and the ways of being made that actually make it work. But it's not untrue to say that there are these films being made, hitting these points every single time. And, you know, I actually remember the scene in a pilot season where the guy goes, I don't think I'm ever supposed to come out of it. You know, like these kinds of reactions, like it's got to hit these certain beats, and it's not untrue. It's like an evil alchemy that actually does work. So look, that's why I'm the film guy I am. I'm trying to champion these films that don't have to have this kind of salesmanship to them that just going to convince you to watch it, especially this one right here. Urgency to watch next episode. This is something I've been talking about actually in the Discord. By the way, the film Discord, go see it. We're there. It's what keeps to me, even these Soprano-like or The Wire, these kind of movies, it keeps them off a notch lower than sort of super sort of intelligent film art, because they still have to have that sort of Walter White, Heisenberg sort of sense of storytelling where they're giving you something. You've got to watch the next one. It's like McDonald's feet puts that flavoring and you have to keep eating. So these things that are meant, they're built around, let's face it, business values, making sure the product keeps getting sold. These things are, a fact of life. They're effective. They work. I watch this stuff. But it is, to me, a shame that this is what everything's been boiled down to. But he's not wrong. They're making millions of dollars off of these things at the bottom. You know, that's the sad fact.
Fair enough. I guess when he says a great show, what he really means is a successful show.
Yeah, one that makes a lot of money. These are business values replacing all other values. We talk about it, you know, you and your lawyer friends, it's all money is the ascendant value. And all of these things are hit as if they're just buttons to be pushed in, you know, making the monkey want to eat another grape.
Monkeys eat grapes?
There was that study they did where they gave the monkey either a grape or a cucumber, and he was angry if the other monkey got a grape and he got a cucumber. Anyway, you know what I'm saying? It's just that you're a rat in a maze. You're being given these sort of programmed
bananas. You're a monkey. You want a banana.
Who ever heard of a monkey eating a banana? No, grapes. They eat grapes. But anyway, so it's you're right that this isn't a guarantee. And obviously some of them are asinine, like a compelling protagonist. But these things, you'll notice they're in. And this is another thing I talk about in my class. You can't really reverse engineer a movie, no matter how much you think like, oh, we can just see what worked in Star Wars, break it down, and it's a guy doing a thing. There's a million attempts to remake Star Wars that didn't work. But there are a few that did, that, you know, look at your Harry Potter franchises, some secret, you know, he's a secret person that's got powers, wish fulfillment. Every action movie that's meant for men is protagonist has hidden abilities, so his superpowers and magic these days. So these are, you know, unfortunately successful things.
Wish fulfillment. You touched on that.
Yeah.
Moral choices. I mean, I guess so.
What other kind of choices are? What to have for dinner? You know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I guess. Yeah, I guess moral choices. I mean, I challenge anybody to write anything that is longer than, you know, 8 minutes long that doesn't involve a moral choice at one point.
Oh,
diverse world building, different geographic landscapes.
Is that all there is to world building?
Yeah, I know, right? Thank you. Who said that, Matt?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, world building is like, you know, a whole other universe that you're in. But, you know, just, hey, some pretty cool, like, landscapes. That's neat, too, I guess.
The ice world really and the weird. Desert world.
Topography, yeah.
Yeah, blue and orange, right?
Urgency to watch next episode, cliffhangers. So
that's the most insidious one to me. Yes, it has to have that.
Yeah, he throws in the industry term at the end there.
But did Sopranos have cliffhanger? I guess they did. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, they totally did. Listen,
I mean, I'm not
built into the course of the season, though. It wasn't like the last minute of the episode was like, Oh boy, what's next?
I don't know. They save the wax for the end. You know, they do that kind of thing. You know,
that's true.
I don't mean to just completely shit on Sopranos. It's a wonderful example of like an intelligent TV show. But that's to me what. It still has to bow to these commercial pressures to keep you wanting to binge it. I mean, people binge it for that reason.
Civilizational high stakes, like a global threat to humanity, like alien invasion or devastating pandemic. Do you need that for a great show? That seems not correct to me.
Well, for if you have it, you probably are upping your chances that people will be compelled by it. It's a cheap score to evoke stakes. But that's why I love a movie like Chantal Ackerman's John Dielman, where it's about a woman basically doing housework and her life falling apart. It's the complete and total opposite of that. If you're interested in actually expanding your world, and looking at smaller things and their importance to you, you're not gonna catch an audience. You know, it requires too much of the audience.
I think like the definition of great show is really at stake here, because the thing that makes a great show to me is that you can be brought in to the stakes that the character feels.
It could be anything.
For The Sopranos, it's his family. It's his status in the crime family, and it's his status within his own family. And the feeling.
Yeah, but Sopranos clicks off those last three: betrayal, positive emotions, negative emotions, and violence.
Don't jump ahead. You're moving the goalpost here. Right. Well, I mean, isn't that the point? Like, I mean, the whole thing is to create stakes that exist for the character, but is somehow relatable, even though it's not directly impacting the viewer. Like, yes, if the world is about to explode, that's going to be a problem for me because I'm in the world. But if you're about to lose your job and I feel something about that, that's a great show.
Yeah, again, he's painting with the broadest possible brush here to capture as wide an audience as possible. What you're asking
God,
for, even in that sense,
what an apologist you are for him.
No, it's not an apology.
Are you
talking
selling
about
your stuff on Amazon now? Are you like moved from eBay to Amazon? What's going on?
No comment. I don't have to get in the mud with you on that. Pay no, attention. I'm just saying. No, that is not what's happening here. I don't disagree with you, but. It's none of these is what makes great film. None of this is what makes art. You know, it's like this is the debate. I think these things are actually plug-inable for this kind of shit that they want to make.
Humor.
I never heard of it.
I mean, I gotta be honest.
You've tried that.
I know. I've tried it, but I don't watch comedy. But I guess it's humor is different than comedy. I barely watch any comedies anymore. I rarely. I'm not watching anything these days. I can't find anything that's good. Somebody suggested Mare from Eastwood or Eastman, and
I've heard that's good. I know a couple of people that
watched it. It's fine. It's not great. It's, you know,
the Does it have humor, betrayal, or civilization?
Yeah, it has
high
all
stakes?
Has humor, has betrayal.
A compelling antagonist?
Has a compelling antagonist. Well, actually, no. We don't really know who the antagonist is yet. It's a murder mystery, so.
Oh, interesting.
There are compelling protagonists, but he has humor, has betrayal, positive emotions. God, this Bezos, he's really on top of it.
You can see
he's hitting a stride right now. He's just going off.
He's closing hard.
Negative emotions, loss and sorrow. Okay. Violence. No sex.
Bit of the old ultra violence. Yeah, I guess it doesn't say sex there. Maybe that's in his next seminar.
God, man. Let's just... You know what I would like to see a show about? I would like to see a show where each week the government raises its taxes, wealth taxes, on Jeff Bezos. So each week we see him lose a progressively larger amount of his fortune. First week, it's $1 billion. And we just watch and see how he reacts to that. And then it's like $5 billion.
Awesome.
And the next week, it's like $10 billion.
And who wants Jeff Bezos to not be a billionaire?
We get him down to like, I don't know, a couple of $100 million. And then it's just like becomes like a thing where like you do some type of like nationwide call in or internet vote to see whether we let him keep it. That to me would be super entertaining. That's it. That would be a great show.
I'd be tuning into that every week. Yes, I would.
Plus, you could finance it with all the money you take from Bezos.
Did this happen to you in real life, Sam? Because this is compelling. You know, this is, again, this is also this whole story of MGM being bought by Amazon. It's another installment in your story of trust busting and monopoly, antitrust. Yeah. You know, that's the real story there. It's nothing to do with the debasement of our entertainment. If MGM does it themselves or somebody else is doing it, it's still this commercial cinema that's being promoted here. They're just now controlling it in the pipeline of distribution.
David Dayan has an interesting piece where he compares what Amazon is doing in this space to the antitrust suit that is being brought by the Attorney General of Washington, D.C. against Amazon. And now he's doing it because Amazon has some business practices where they basically say more or less, there's some nuance here, but it's more or less, you cannot sell anything cheaper than you sell it on Amazon. You can't sell it cheaper at your website. You can't sell it cheaper anywhere else, or we kick you off and you lose access. And what it does is it has the impact of creating upward price pressure. And Dayan suspects that what this is about, why Amazon is getting into this business, is that Amazon doesn't, you know, has its Prime Video as a service that is not a separate service from its Prime membership.
Mm-hmm.
And so their video offerings is just like a slice of their business.
Yeah, come for the free shipping, stay for the superhero shows.
Actually, it's come for the superhero shows, stay for the free shipping.
Ah.
But what it does is it will also have the long-term impact of driving up prices for its competing thing, like Netflix, let's say, because they don't have another business to subsidize it. And, with Amazon in there buying, you know, this stuff, it's going to make content more expensive.
So does he think that will finally turn on the light of antitrust the way we've been thinking of it in price terms? No,
I don't think in this instance it will necessarily. That's almost way too sophisticated, because what it is is there's a limited amount of content out there. It will drive up the prices a little bit for web streaming services. And it already is like, look, I'm convinced short of Netflix, short of Amazon, like these networks that are getting into these streaming things, forget about it. It ain't working. It ain't working.
I mean, I got Disney Plus, I got CBS All Access, I got Hulu. I mean, you know, what's not working? I guess I'm a mark.
Well, I'll tell you what's not working is because, like, at one point you're paying significantly more than you were for cable. And
I'm also paying for cable, so.
Oh, you are? Oh, that's nuts. But at one point it's just going to be too much, and it's just the profit margins aren't there. There's just too much competition. I think I think some of these streaming services are not long. I think there's going to be a contraction. That's my
sense. Listen, I in my lane as the film guy, I try to say, like, you know, I feel like fighting the corporate league, you know, funded and distributed film pipeline and trying to raise up the sort of the smaller voices, the less commercial voices that are making what are still, I think, important films that are actually valuable to society, valuable to humanity. It's sort of like climate change, you know, like I advocate for individual choices to push it, but it has to also be on a policy level, you know, it has to also be this greater decision that we should support these other kinds of filmmaking that aren't just this, you know, this product, this easily consumable, disposable product that just goes in one ear and out the other and makes you keep clicking and compelled to keep paying for the service.
When you say we should support, are you saying this that as consumers, we should support this, or we should support it as our government should support it, or what?
Both. I right now, the best thing you can do, I think, is twofold. Is, like, I see myself as advocating for the value of these films, so people will go out and get them, will go find them. And right now, it's primarily the best stuff is, you know, sad to say, foreign films and the things that are actually supported by their governments, although those are imperfect systems as well. But, and also try to advocate for a greater sort of awareness of the control that this kind of, you know, what do you call it, verticality has on what you're able to see. It's not just the prices. It's the, you know, it's the coarsening of the culture.
Who's got the best system? What government do you think provides the best, means of support for its filmmaking?
I can't tell you, because if you ask the French people, they hate their system, yet they get public funding. If you ask people in, you know, like, one of my favorite filmmakers is Nuri Bilge Ceylan in Turkey. Well, he has to fight censors all the time, but he still makes these wonderful art films. So I couldn't tell you who has the most freedom and who has the most support. It's a problem everywhere because, honestly, the Western culture is like a behemoth. It's taking over everything.
Has anybody written a book on that? Like, why hasn't anybody studied that? This is maybe why somebody can't have good things.
Give me
Brendan
some homework.
Says Australia. Australia is, as you know, I mean, it's pretty supportive of its.
Yeah, I have a friend who's made it a couple films there. But again, everyone complains about the board and what they choose and who's important. You know, I'm thinking of Taika Waititi. There's a lot of resentment of his success there because he made sort of commercial movies and he started out, you know, using the sort of art film system to make a name for himself and has gone on to make, dare I say,
they all do that. Movies. They all
yeah.
do that.
But it's a bigger problem than just it's more than one factor that's causing this. And this is why I'm out here in the wilderness saying, hey, art is still important. Art still is about a sort of a small sort of personal experience you could have that actually can affect your life and be valuable. And art, movies, shows don't have to just be turn off your mind, relax and float downstream and just, you know, trashy vegging out. Although I do that, too.
Matthew, film guy, what better way than to lead up to your suggestion of what we should watch this weekend as we stream? I feel like I almost watched something that you recommended recently, and then I forgot. That's part of the problem, is that, like, I write it down on my desk, and I can't tell you, like, the number of papers that are here. And at the end of the show, inevitably, it goes, like, I'm just like, I gotta put this in the recycling bin. And I'm like, where is the thing that I wrote down?
It's okay. I forgive you, my son. It's fine. I understand you're trying.
I hope you know, you should a list of this in the Discord.
Well,
I go in there with my sock puppet and I look around at stuff and then I run out.
Are you structural butthole?
In my real life, I am, but not on the Discord.
Thank you, Tushy. Hello, Tushy. you should join Letterboxd. You can go follow me on Letterboxd. I'm at Langdon Boom on Letterboxd. That's where I keep a diary of all my films. And there's a list that I actually have, I think, pinned to the Discord in the Film and TV Discord on the Majority Report Discord.
Do you have a comprehensive list of every film you've recommended on this show?
Yes. And all the films. You can click the link to my Letterboxd, and on there you can click my lists and you can see all the films I recommended on this show since the start, going back almost 10 years now, and every film I've shown in my class.
That's nuts that we've been doing this for 10 years.
I know. But think of all the lives we've changed, the hearts we've touched.
All right. So, Matthew, film guy.
Yes. By the way, did you say you wanted to, I'll give you it in 1 second, but I'm going to stall for this question. Did you say you were going to try to get Adam Curtis on the show? Because
I've been wanting to do that for a long time.
Let's do a three-way Zoom so I can just be here. And because I got a million questions for that guy, on a filmmaking level.
You know what? What we'll do is we'll do this. We'll have him on and we'll bring you on. You'll be a guest. I'm not going to say full host, but you'll be a guest.
If I get two questions, I'll be happy.
Okay. I will say this. You know what I did see the other day? Because Benjamin told me to watch it. And I was like, it was just a completely spontaneous thing. Nobody. That new Bob Odenkirk film. Did you freeze?
Did he really? Wow.
I mean, I guess he was so offended that I listened to a movie that John Benjamin recommended that he basically it completely froze up his entire Zoom.
You can tell on the look on his face.
Oh,
too.
Wait a second. I know what's going on here. This is like point number 7 on the list, the cliffhanger.
Wow.
This is where, right? This is what's he doing? He's not going to call. All right. He'll call back in. We got to get on it. I mean, we've been talking to him forever. It seems like, jeez, you better show up quick. We'll give him another second. Hey, I wonder if the power went out at his place or something. That was weird.
Did you like Nobody?
I did like Nobody. I got to say. And I'm not like I am very happy to be critical of Bob Odenkirk.
Yes, it's true.
But I got to say, I really liked the movie.
How did he do in his action scenes?
He did fine. He did fine. Action films are like, you know, sadly, like at the end of the day, my brain's so tired that all I want to do is action films. Well, let's see. Are we going to get Matthew back or what's the deal?
I'll let you know if he comes back.
Well, we're going to move on with the show. I guess we're going to have the recommendation this week will be.
Wow, Sam, maybe you give a recommendation for once.
Maybe it's Nobody.
Nobody. I mean, look, it's an action film, but it's got a sense of humor to it. The action isn't like over the top. There is, it's pretty good. Apparently it was filmed in Winnipeg, Manitoba, according to Winnipeg Craig, North America's new COVID capital. Yeah. They went up to Canada to shoot that. My understanding is, and production started back up from what I understand in terms of like my friends in the, it's still in the biz. Production is starting back up. Sammy Key says all this extra talk is has me planning to rewatch Slacker and Sex Lies and Videotape. If you watch the funny thing about Reality Bites is it is the story it tells internally is also sort of what it's doing relative to Slacker. I don't know if that makes sense, but I hope everything's okay with Matthew. I'm not hearing from him. Hold on, let me gonna call him. Let's see. See what's going on there. This is
hello.
Hey, dude, you're on the air. What's going on?
I don't know. Something dropped.
Well, did you try and sign back up? Did you try?
Yes. I'm restarting. I don't know what happened. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'll be right back.
This is a show, you know. It's not like
this is going out. Oh,
shoot.
All right. He's going to come back, folks. In the meantime, where do I have, where's my sound sheet? Oh my God. Look at this. This is what happens. Emma takes a day and then I, everything falls to pieces.
Assembly. Let's see
what we should look at here. Oh, here we go. Let's just go into, let's do this. Oh my God. Marjorie Taylor Greene has completely lost her mind. She's always been, but here is Marjorie Taylor Greene. Let's play this clip just as a palate cleanser.
Here she is. Trafficking.
Now this is, we'll be clear. This is the Matt Gaetz. She and Matt Gaetz are on tour, aren't they?
Yeah, they're on tour.
And it's an America First rally. I wonder if it's been licensed by Donald Trump. And they're on tour because, of course, she has nothing to do. She's not in any committees. So she's really, she really is living the life. Matt Gaetz is up there talking about, you know, we have a Second Amendment to maybe storm the Capitol if we feel like it's necessary, or maybe and presumably use it against tech executives. Here's Marjorie Taylor Greene with a new theory about Democrats and their relationship to drug cartels. And here she is making an in the moment decision as to whether she thinks she can get mileage, the sort of reactionary mileage and the aggrievement mileage out of this accent that she's contemplating. Watch this.
Trafficking. No, they're in business of helping the cartels. The cartels love the Democrats. Yeah, they're down there. They're like this. They're like, we're making a lot of money off of Biden, Joe Biden. That's my really bad Mexican accent.
Pretty bad accent. The Mexican cartels. We're making a lot of money off of Joe Biden. That was Marjorie Taylor Greene. It just feels like they are they're throwing anything against the wall right now to see what sticks. But I wouldn't be surprised if in 6 months that becomes interwoven into the Q canon, as it were.
Sorry, guys. I don't know what happened there. The deep state got me.
All right. So I was saying I watched Nobody and I liked it. And that's that. It's worth seeing if you want, you know.
I like Bob Odenkirk in his various guises.
You know how I like action films. You know that.
Yeah, I know. Ronin is your urtext.
I don't know about that, but Ronin pretty good. Well, only because it was recent. Like, I don't love Ronin.
Recent. That was 20, over 20 years now.
Well, but it was the last one of those type of it's Frankenheimer, right? And
yep.
And he was very good with the car chases.
Indeed.
That was his sort of big thing.
You remind me, I think one of the ones that I recommended to you in the early days that you loved was the Brazil films Elite Squad 1 and 2.
Whenever I think of you and action, the Elite Squad was great. Like, I like ones that are smart and they're not just about the action. It's just that that's the, and they don't make those that much anymore.
No, I mean, you want to more betrayal, more positive emotions, but also violence.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, all right, what do you have for us this week, Matthew Film Guy?
Okay, I suggest you see a film by a filmmaker who I'm sure you remember, Thomas Vinterberg. You remember
Vinterberg,
his film?
Vinterberg, yes, of course, the Dogma 95 guys.
That's right. Well, he's thrown the video camera away, or more like the video cameras have grown up to look like film cameras. And yeah, and I know you remember him because he's got the title for first DV film and You Shot on Digital Video and so on. But it was his latest film that I think reignited my love for his work. I can't say that he actually made a couple sort of action movies. He made a submarine movie and so on. But his latest film is called, the English title is Another Round. And the Danish title is, I think, Druk, which translates directly to binge drinking. And this was one of those movies that it's sort of high concept. When you hear the concept, you're like, okay, this could go either way. And it wound up being, I think, one of the greatest films that I've seen, definitely from 2020 and possibly in the 21st century, because it was. I'm trying not to oversell it, but it was so life affirming. It was life affirming. Okay. Is that overselling it? It's about a guy who he and his friends have this sort of bet that they could sort of just maintain a certain blood alcohol level. There's some theory, crackpot theory, they read that says, like, we were born with a slightly below the natural level. We should have like a 0.05 blood alcohol level at all times. So they try to institute this sort of secret plan. They're teachers at a school, and they're all sort of like midlife crisis-y. So it's wonderful. And they do this thing, and I don't want to tell you where it goes. It goes to places you think it would. It goes to places you wouldn't think it would go. And it just winds up being so effing amazing what it does to you. It puts your emotions in the blender and gets you to kind of remember that life can be good, even though it's terrible.
That's exactly what I need.
I know. That's what I thought, too. And it's funny. It's sad. It has emotions. I think it has betrayal. I'm not sure how many of the Bezos rules it follows, but it definitely is the most excited I've been about a movie, a new movie, especially, in quite a while. So I say everybody should go check out Another Round. We've been talking about it on the Discord too.
I think that's happening. Vinterberg, yeah. you hit the sweet spot with me, which is like something that I'm already comfortable with.
Someone you kind of know, you're in good hands. And it stars Mads Mikkelsen, who's been in a million great movies lately, from the sort of the big budget to the low budget.
Mads Mikkelsen,
you'll see him. You'll probably see that guy. That Nordic looking dude speaking his native language. It doesn't make drinking seem great. I don't know if you remember the movie Lost Weekend about the alcoholic from the 40s. That's another great movie, but it's not quite the tisk tisk on drinking. It's like really amazing how they skirt the line of moralizing and just to achieve like a real human truth.
It was Vinterberg and von Trier, right? Those are the two guys. I mean, I am inexorably intertwined because we were doing our digital video film when they came out with theirs, and they were just much smarter about it.
Well, they marketed it. You know, they had a dogma manifesto.
And we were operating under that dogma, and we just didn't think that, like.
Yeah. When you had no lighting, it was just for practical reasons. They made it a point of pride.
Exactly. Well, that also reminds me of, like, what was it, Robert Rodriguez, when he made that first movie? El Mariachi. And he couldn't maintain sync, so he kept editing every whatever it was. 25 seconds or something, and people are like, that's an amazing new editing style.
He's fast. Like, yes.
Yeah, it is.
Listen, that's another thing about these billion-dollar movies. Sometimes the greater the limits, the greater the art. You know, it forces you to
be creative.
Well,
that's the whole dogma theory. And that was my theory too, actually. I didn't think enough to make it into a theory. It was just, I think I used to say, like, they would teach you at AFI that you write for the castle and you shoot under the bridge.
Oh, and I like that. I never heard that one.
That was the AFI one, but mine was always, no, if I get the bridge, I'm just going to write for the bridge.
Right. I thought it was a write Yiddish cast British. Did you not do that one?
I wasn't going to do that.
That was Neil Simon. That's right. You're like, write Yiddish cast Yiddish.
Exactly.
New. Okay.
Exactly.
That reminds me.
Matthew,
yes. Did you want to sign me off?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's why I'm going to keep talking. I just wanted to say Charles Grodin. You mentioned him briefly, but I feel like he was sort of a, I don't know, I want to say like a template for some of the things that you wanted to do in some ways, maybe.
His style of comedy. Yeah.
The Elaine May movie Heartbreak Kid. Yeah. That's worth seeing. And also just one more in memoriam. I want to say a filmmaker named Milton Moses Ginsberg passed away. He made a movie, I don't know if you ever saw it, called Coming Apart. It was Rip Torn in his, it was like one of the first sort of like, not found footage, but it was like he hid a camera in his apartment and he was a therapist. And it was like all the different sort of sessions he had. And then he started to sort of like seduce some of the women and have these adventures. And it was very 60s kind of like, but it's, he made one movie really that was that good. And went on to be an editor, which, you know, no shame in just being an editor. But Milton Moses Ginsberg passed away this week. And so if people want to check out Coming Apart, that's another one of my favorites of all time.
Matthew Film Guy, always a pleasure. Folks can find you at Langdon Boom. They can find you in the Discord, which will lead to your links throughout the universe.
And I think I'll be doing Gene Bajelon's podcast, This is Revolution, next week, too, if you want to hear more from the film.
Wow, exciting.
Yeah, it is. Thanks, Sam.
Bye, Matthew.
Bye.
Well, folks, it's a freebie Friday. I don't know what to tell you. We only got about 30 minutes left anyways. And a little longer. We're not going to take calls today, but we will take your IMs. What's old is new again, ladies and gentlemen. I've spoken many times. You know, we should pull these up, actually. You should assemble these and just put them out as like a compilation for members. But back in the day, what was very big in the mid-aughts was a focus on the family and the American Family Association and family. These were Christian organizations that were worried about the onslaught of the gay agenda that was cresting at that time. So much so that George Bush had to come out and announce in a primetime press conference that he was going to support a constitutional amendment to outlaw marriage equality. One of the things that I think it was the focus on the family, they had a entertainment division, had cracked the case of A Shark's Tale, wherein children were getting subliminal messages that it was okay to be different and to cross dress as a dolphin when you were a shark. You understand what the message that is giving to the kids, that it's okay to be gay or transgender or transvestite. Now, I thought we had all passed that, but apparently we haven't. They're bringing it back, folks. This is part of the sort of like, you know, transgender has become the new gay in terms of it's being leveraged within this culture war that is being waged on the right for the most part. But I guess, you know, you could say it's on the left in the sense that like people are saying people have a right to exist and live their lives. And it's not a big deal. But here is Trish Regan trying to bring it back. This is all about indoctrinating the kids.
And so sometimes you wonder if this is influencing the kids. Like, where are they getting this from?
Sure.
And why is there so much like sexuality being pushed on the kids in schools? As you pointed out, like, this is not something I would have thought about when I was at that age.
Remember that the penguin book that was such a big deal in New York City, and they were reading it to nursery school kids because there were some gay penguins in the New York City. Like, who cares, right? Like, why are we talking about gay penguins? Why don't we even have to talk about straight penguins, like falling in love? Can't, you know, it be like a nice little story about a kid and their dog or something? I'm sorry, but I just think that there's a time and place for everything. And as a society, we have moved our children along way too fast. Let's take a time out. Let kids be kids.
Yeah, let's not teach them about love because gay people exist.
Exactly. Let's not teach them how to deal with their emotions. Let's not teach them how to accept themselves as they are. Let's just let kids be kids. I don't know if you've ever been a kid, but kids can also be super mean, really mean. And I don't know if you've ever been a kid and grown up and been an adult, but those scars can actually hang around for a long time. You know, that I will say this, the 60 Minutes thing, you know, it is fascinating to see. I mean, first of all, it has been trafficked throughout the entire right wing. They are using this story. And the 60 Minutes story was they did a couple of interviews with people who had regretted their transition. They had either gotten surgery or had started to take hormones, and they had regretted their transition. and had transitioned back. And they told stories about how when they sought out advice on transitioning, that it was almost too easy for them to have access of the surgery or the drug regimen. And, you know, the issue that I think people are taking with that piece by 60 Minutes is the piece in and of itself was, I think, you know, if you look at it in a vacuum, it was fair. Now, I don't mean fair in terms of balance. I mean, like, it was okay. It was decent, except for the fact that there was no hard numbers. So it created the sense. I mean, when 60 Minutes does a story, by the very nature of them doing a story, they add weight to the story. 60 Minutes brings five people on there, and they've all been struck by lightning when they were out playing baseball, right? People are going to be afraid, and they did so when there was no rain. They were struck by lightning. Tell us your story. Well, I was out there. I was playing softball, and I was just on the mound. It was no rain. They said that rain was coming, but then all of a sudden I was struck by lightning. And you bring five people on there to talk about that. And you say, we have no real data on how many times this happens to people, but it seems to be a problem, which is essentially what they did with these people. Yeah, it's fair. There were five people struck by lightning when it wasn't raining. And you said you don't have any data. And at one point you said even like, but for the most part, you're perfectly safe when there's no rain out when you're playing softball. The fact is that by the very nature of doing a story on 60 Minutes of it, and you leave the parameters of that story so nebulous, you are implying that this is the story about playing softball, that you have an opportunity to get struck by lightning even if it's not raining.
Yeah, emphasis is a message in and of itself.
Without a doubt. And many of the people who are pushing back on this, forget the right, the so-called right, or, you know, the obvious right. There are other people who are pushing back on this and saying, like, you know, this is the fact that, you know, that GLAAD is mad about it or whatnot is an example of how you can't tell the truth. No, the production itself, like, I mean, let's be clear. There are editorial decisions that are made that communicate something about the story just by the very nature of them getting attention and what kind of attention they get. And I don't know how many stories 60 Minutes have done about transgender kids being unable to access care. I imagine they've done some. I don't know how many stories they've done about transgender kids committing suicide because of the difficulty of getting healthcare services, because of the stigma, because of bullying, or just because of violence. I don't know how many stories 60 Minutes has done. But let's be clear, if you were to look at, there's no doubt in my mind that the percentage, if you were to break down, and really it seems, if you don't have the ability as a news outlet to quantify what you're presenting as a potential problem, you're really doing a disservice. Because you're not giving anybody the sense that, like, look, the fact of the matter is you can go out and you can play softball. And if it's not raining, for all intents and purposes, you're not going to get struck by lightning. And in fact, just the fact that I can come up with that hypothetical and the analogy, and no one could even refute that the likelihood of getting struck by lightning, playing softball when it's not raining, is any greater or less than the likelihood of transitioning and regretting it and perhaps getting too far through that transition process that it fundamentally alters your life throughout your life or creates even greater emotional issues than you were dealing with. The fact that nobody can refute that after 60 Minutes has done that report is indicative of the potential and really the actual, how misleading it is. And it's even worse than that because we've had phenomena in this country which are like this, right? Where if it bleeds, it leads. You watch local news and you will think that your city is crime ridden because that's all they put up there. And that has implications. But at a time where you have a political movement that is using transgender people as a leverage point, bathrooms, whatever it is, like they're using this as a political leverage tool, and it is creating that much more difficulty and violence towards transgender people. It's highly irresponsible. It's highly irresponsible. And I don't know the definition of transphobia, but it disregards trans people's lives so much to be that irresponsible that it certainly is arguably transphobic. It certainly is in terms of what it will lead to. And so I just found it really sort of reprehensible. And I watched the segment and blah, blah, blah. I mean, you know, like I say, which isn't to say that, like, they can't do a segment like that, but it really should be in the context of a broader story. Because that's really what it is. It is a subset of a broader story. And I doubt that they have told that story too much, the broader story.
Yeah, you have to address that. You can't talk about it as if it's in a vacuum.
Exactly. Exactly. The story is not that too many people are transitioning on a whim and regret it. That's an A story, but it's not the story when it comes to transgender kids. I didn't expect Trish Regan to set me off that way. And gosh, poor Trish. She's on OWN now. She's not on Fox anymore, right? She got bumped.
Wow. I didn't even notice that. That's sad.
Let's hear Stuart Varney display his absolute ignorance of history. Here he is on Fox Business opining about something that he couldn't even be bothered, apparently, to Google.
I honestly thought it was a joke. Senator Elizabeth Warren stridently attacking top banker Jamie Dimon about overdraft fees. What a spectacle. Now, I guess that if you personally have been hit with an overdraft fee, you might think that this is an important issue. Sorry, folks. In the great scheme of things, it is not. There are far bigger fish to fry than overdraft fees. But this was Senator Warren's opportunity to show just how much she dislikes those wicked bankers. We've seen her in action before. We'll no doubt see her again. Her contempt for bankers and banks knows no bounds. But there's something more going on here. The left wants the banks to get in line with their social revolution. Big corporations are already on board with social justice. The left wants the banks on board with climate change, racial justice, unionization, workers on the board. And Senator Warren wants to control exactly who gets a loan from a bank. And it wouldn't be you now, would it? If you actually sat through yesterday's hearings, you would have heard the left play at theatrics. And I'm sure that to some people, bashing the fat cats has some appeal. America's most powerful bankers, all lined up on those Zoom screens, they make an easy target, don't they? But people who are serious about money will not be happy to see the entire banking industry pilloried like this. We need a stable, solid, profitable banking system like the one we've got. Seriously, do you want a socialist, government-run bank that decides who gets a loan, who gets a job, and which industries get investment cash? That's not the way we should be doing things in capitalist America. Third,
he doesn't even make really any type of substantive argument. It's all just sort of like, you know, do you want? We had we had public banking run by the post office into the 60s. And I don't know if they did any big loans, but the idea of a public bank, we have one in, what is it, North Dakota?
Yep, North Dakota. They paid for me to go study abroad in the UK, actually.
Well, Stuart Varney was right. I guess it was a huge mistake for them to provide you loans to do
from his perspective, yeah.
North Dakota, they have a publicly owned bank. Of course you would want one. Of course you would want a bank that is assessing the value of a loan, not just in, the ability to pay, but B, and there should be, there's a fiduciary responsibility. That's why they call them loan officers. It's why actually they should have all been held to account far more so in the mortgage crisis, because they failed at their fiduciary responsibility as a loan officer in assessing the risks associated with the loans. They were just chasing their fees. So a bank that doesn't have, where you don't have, you don't have a profit motive. You have a motive to maintain the capitalization of the bank. You have a motive to make sure that we're not making unsafe loans that that affect the capitalization of the bank. But without the profit motive, your assessment of someone being loan worthy becomes far more responsible. Your assessment of someone being loan worthy also becomes far more community minded. You actually can take into account, like, hey, this community does need another grocery store. This community does need another ice cream stand. This community does need a car dealership. This community does need people who are able to travel abroad, go to school in a foreign country, whatever it is. Bankers supposedly do that now, but they also get intertwined with a profit motive. If these private banks are so great, let's test Stuart Varney's proposition. Let's have a national bank. Let's have state-run banks across the country. Let them compete. Then while we're at it, let's also have a public option for healthcare. Just as a starting point, we get a real good sense of it. They're terrified.
He mentions like bankers and also like mass decision-making about climate change. Part of the reason we're not doing anything is how invested all these bankers are in the oil economy.
Yeah. You're already starting to see the change, right? I mean, in Denmark, they basically said to the Royal Dutch company, like, you need to be zero emissions, I think, by 2050. So in other words, change your business model. You're seeing this with this hedge fund that was set up to get a bunch of members of the Exxon's board elected. They got two elected at least at this point. This is making it more expensive to loan to those companies is, one methodology. But another method would be have the bankers actually concerned about issues that affect society that are really externalities of their business. I mean, that's basically what's going on. People should understand this. for both the banker and for anybody dealing with these oil companies. They are making money by offloading the externalities of their profit making to society. They are privatizing the profits. They are socializing the costs. What makes this even more egregious is that the costs that they're socializing are ones that you can't just pay for with money. You pay for in lives. You pay for in the destruction of the planet. And there may not be enough cash to slow that down. I mean, I guess maybe you keep printing money and see if you could like maybe somehow, I don't know, make some type of funnel where the heat, the greenhouse gases go out into the universe. But I don't have the scientific know-how to explain that. But I mean, that's the bottom line. You're externalizing the cost of them making profit. All right, let's do some IMs. Oh, well, let's do this one last thing. All right. Here is Ben Shapiro and like the, what do they call this? What do they call this thing? The Daily Wire backstage.
That's right.
It's like the Dragon's Den or something.
Yeah. The problem is it's clearly a set. And so it's not really backstage, but they're just more relaxed. They're having a cigar. They're pretending they're drinking. They are doing the most banal and sad attempts at establishing their masculinity bona fides here. We're all men. We're all manly men. Here's the proof. We have a cigar and we're drinking scotch. And here it is. And then, of course, we also all happen to be white men. Straight white men, and we're all going to talk about how oppressed we are in this society as we sit here with hundreds of dollars of bottles of liquor and our super expensive cigars and our...
Got some M&Ms there too.
And candy.
Yeah. Candy, antipasta.
I'm getting into that candy, although that's pretty nasty. Like, I don't... No, if they're watching,
you don't want cigar smoke on your M&Ms.
A little bit of scotch in M&Ms.
I don't want Andrew Clavin's hand grease on my M&Ms.
Now, who are all these guys? We got that guy Knowles, right? The failed actor Knowles.
The guy with the glasses is too boring. I can never remember his name.
Dude, that's actually his name. His name is Jeremy Boring.
There's Jeremy Boring, and there's that Clavin guy, Cliff Clavin. And Ben Shapiro. Yeah. All right. So,
well, this is a hallmark of their entire foreign policy, right? Which is never let the facts get in the way of your ideology.
But it's also the racial stuff just makes it impossible, I think, for modern day Democrats. That's why we've heard some people in the media saying, and they deleted some of the tweets, but saying that, of course, it's racist. They were saying that for a year, but some are still saying it's racist.
The New York Times reported today.
Just today. So the fact that Chinese people are not white is a big political problem for Joe Biden and the Democrats. Yeah, no. I think in some ways it's as simple as that. That you know, this came from a place where these are not white people, and so it's
this is getting very offensive. I was in Washington's D.C.'s Chinatown the other day, and there's a big lit poster, an electric poster, telling us not to hate Asian people. I'm beginning to be offended by these signs telling me not to hate people. First of all, screw you. Who the hell are you to tell
me? I'll hate whoever I want.
But I will hate whoever I want. And why? What makes them think this?
Pause it for a second. I want to just put this in context, and we can go back a little bit. We should go back, but just understand, like, what has been the constant refrain and complaint from these type of people for months, if not years? I am hated. I'm not allowed to express my opinion.
Yeah, be nicer to Trump voters.
I be nicer to Trump voters. You have no idea how oppressed we are by going around. People hate me because I just have a different perspective on things. But now it is just offensive for him when he is in Chinatown, the idea that there would be signs saying don't hate Asian American people at a time where we have rampant anti-Asian violence. I wonder if Claiborne had such an issue with the protestations for people not to be commit anti-Semitic violence. I wonder why. I mean, because are we not hearing that? Are we not hearing that? There has been an increase in anti-Semitism, and we're certainly hearing. I haven't seen necessarily a poster, but I don't go anywhere. Just generally, but I imagine there is. And I imagine Klavan has seen this on its Facebook. We need to stop anti-Semitism. I wonder why he doesn't complain about that. Good.
This is getting very offensive. I was in Washington's, D.C.'s Chinatown the other day, and there's a big lit poster, an electric poster, telling us not to hate Asian people. I'm beginning to be offended by these signs telling me not to hate people. First of all, screw you. Who the hell are you to tell
me? I'll hate whoever I want.
But I will hate whoever I want. And why? What makes them think this country that has been so welcoming to everybody, needs a lecture from corporate toadies who are doing business with the Chinese?
Pause it. First off, I love how that guy Knowles, or whatever that guy's name is, thinks that Klavan's joking because it's so preposterous.
Yep.
But does Klavan not, like, do these people, like, do they take a class in how to not know any history? Like, the literally laws passed against Chinese people in this country.
The Chinese Exclusion Act.
I mean, it couldn't be any more explicit than that. When they came to this country, it took about like 10 years for there to be any numbers of Chinese immigrants before you get that. Before you get all sorts of laws, Chinese Exclusion Act. But there was a whole another series of laws that were meant to prevent Chinese people from getting work. At first, they were welcomed. And then, within a couple of years, that's all it took. It's amazing how ahistorical these guys are. Like, there's no history except for what happened to me couple nights ago when I went out to dinner. That's it. That's their sense of history. Continue.
Everybody needs a lecture from corporate toadies who are doing business with the Chinese and doing business to the point where they won't criticize them. Why are they lecturing me? Anybody who can afford that sign shouldn't be lecturing me.
Put a sign about how we shouldn't hate Asian people up at the Harvard admittance.
Right.
Yeah, right. Well, first off, I mean, he's created this straw man. As opposed to in Chinatown, it's like big corporations are putting up the signs, as opposed to a community that is feeling we're being assaulted on the streets for being Chinese Americans. And I've got news for you. There's a difference between trying to maintain diversity and saying we hate Chinese people or Asian people. These guys, it's impressive.
Yeah. It's a shame they didn't have an Asian person there to say whether or not they think, the real problem is affirmative action and not, hate crimes in the street. But,
well, how could you do that? How could you talk to an Asian person about that? That's just what the corporate cronies want you to do. Rob from March 2024, Speaker Trump has just confirmed impeachment of a President Biden's Republican Senate, not likely to have enough votes to remove from office. Ned Cheetah, don't waste time imagining some Biden strategy to pressure Manchin. Biden's only strategy is to lay the groundwork for a Paul Ryan victory in 2024. As an elementary teacher, I was once generally opposed to too much violent video game play for kids. As the husband who snuck GTA into the house for my elementary age daughters, I feel no shame. As the father making breakfast after a sleepover, hearing pistol whip him from my third grade daughter's friend from hometown, I was comforted. Other fathers are horrible, and great minds in Grand Theft Auto will shape this world. Happy Friday. That's funny. Sport with Emma Vigeland. I firmly believe criticism of Israel shouldn't equate to anti-Semitism. As a Jewish person, this tactic has long exhausted me, especially when used against Bernie. However, I've been startled with some of the ire misdirected at Jewish people and general anti-Semitism I've been anecdotally seeing as a result of Israel's aggression towards Palestinians. I also find it troubling many on the left are not just ambivalent to call it out, but angered when AOC or Bernie do. Calling out anti-Semitism isn't a distraction from our Palestinian brothers and sisters' struggle. Calling out anti-Semitism is calling out anti-Semitism. and it's important, and we need to stand for one another. I agree with you. I think part of the problem is that the equation of criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism by disingenuous people on the right, some in the Jewish community, some not, is what drives the anti-Semitism. Because once you say criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism, then it only logically follows that if you are mad at Israel, you're mad at Jews. Like, I mean, they're, and I'm not justifying this at all. But it gives license to people who are anti-Semitic to do this. You know, make no mistake, this isn't making new anti-Semites. It is anti-Semites feeling emboldened in this time. Because there is criticism of Israel, and so much of that criticism has been rejected as anti-Semitic. But yes, I agree with you. I mean, I don't think it what's going on in terms of the Palestinians is genocide. It is ethnic cleansing. It is ethnic cleansing. And that may be just on the same spectrum. But I wish everybody who had said, I shouldn't have said genocide, I should have said ethnic cleansing. I think from the beginning I've called it ethnic cleansing, but I think that's, it's just simply a factual statement. It just simply is. What's going on there is ethnic cleansing, and it's just as repulsive. It's and ethnic cleansing certainly can lead to genocide, but I do think it is ethnic cleansing. And then there's also massacres. Force the Croat. Matt Gaetz, 2022 platform, shoot Democrats and tech CEOs, lower the age of consent. All right, we'll do this for 7 more minutes. Demian, did Twitch really ban hot tub streaming? Does this mean we won't ever get a chance to stream Sam and Matt sitting in a hot tub talking about policy ideas to prevent hedge funds and corporations from hoarding housing? What can be done about housing being used as investments in this way? Hassan Piker has some good ideas, but this seems to be something that needs to be taken care of immediately. It's bad. Truth will set you free. Thanks for the deepity, Joe. I think you can levy taxes on empty apartments. I think you can levy serious taxes on multiple dwellings. I think we need to get hedge funds and banks out of like the housing business. But I also think we need to have just like, you know, more public housing. Mark's attacks. Hey, Sam, Emma, Matt, Brendan, my girlfriend and I had to say goodbye to our 14-year-old Beagle, Basset Hound mix, Winston, on Wednesday. As horrible as the pandemic has been, truly appreciated being able to work from home and spend so much extra time with Winston. Thank you so much for keeping us informed and entertainment through such a difficult time. This is for Winston. That's hard. Eric from Iowa, this really feels like 2011 all over again. Obama came in with a majority in both houses. Senate did nothing with it. Democrats are repeating the same mistake with Manchin, and the stakes are even higher now. Look forward to absolutely getting murdered in the midterms. Well, that last sentence may be the case, but it really isn't. It's different than 09 and 11. It's different. We'll see. Joey T-Bar, thought experiment. If you could pick the members of Congress to be flipped, would you rather one senator or 10 House members, and whom? Well, 10 House members, you'd lose the House, I think. Right? Is it a 10?
Yeah.
I mean, I would rather keep all the senators and keep the House. And as to who, that would be, that takes a lot longer. Preg hosts Limer. Does the threshold for cloture vote not go down based on who's there? I thought it would be 60% of whoever's there. No, you need 60. That's the thing. One of the reforms that people have talked about is you need to have 40 votes or 41 votes to keep debate open, as opposed to 60 votes to keep debate closed, to close debate. So the obligation is on the 60. That's why. One of the reforms was just like, make them vote, make there be 40 votes. All right, let's go through some of these. Liam, is this really your last step? No. The Tim Caucus, I wonder, considering how Schumer's letter is structured, if these bills haven't been much on the recent radar, paycheck fairness, equality, gun reform are the chum. S1 is geared to be the first post-filibuster reform after the other failures have enraged liberal voters and shorn up Manchin's conservative bona fides. Maybe. What platform are Champagne Sharks on? I'm not sure. That's a good question.
Podcast.
Big structure butthole. Sam, asks this pretender how he can call himself a film guy without having seen Mean Girls. Majority Report's wardrobe coordinator. Man, it's too bad Emma's out today. I want to talk to her about her favorite quarterback. Let's see here. Thames Darwin, Youth International Party is the Yippies. Oh, thank you. Jay Tingle. Mayor of Easttown is the main character's actual antagonist. She's the worst kind of cop, narcissistic and corrupt, no self-control, incredibly destructive. She harms everyone she comes in contact with, and the system rewards her. All right, let's see. Adult film actors, Sam Seedher. Just wanted to shout out to the NYU grad student worker union who made a complete protection of students from an ICE non-negotiable demand, got NYU to concede and immediately afterward joined the general strike for Palestinian lives. Michael Brooks was right. Global intergroup solidarity is the only path forward for the labor movement. Two more minutes. Rents here in Melbourne. We've got back to lockdown after another hotel quarantine breach resulted in 10 COVID cases in the broader community. Stood in line for 6 hours yesterday to get a vaccine. Get your vaccine, folks. Every shot saves a life, maybe even yours. I spent some time in Melbourne. Another day I'll talk about it. Sam's only fan. Hey, Sam, why AMQ stopped downloading new episodes on Apple Podcast? I didn't know that it had. We'll check into that. Mickey 7. Kids are the worst. And the final IM of the week. Where are we here? Mind Pillow Guy. Sam, can you explain to me how a perverted joker like Tim Heidecker gets guests like Abby Martin on his hellish clown show on YouTube and you still haven't? They were talking about Palestinians being massacred on the IDF between dick jokes and fart sound effects. It was just shameful, and Tim's behavior, as usual, was just disgusting. All right, folks. See you, Matt, Brendan, Emma, wherever you are. Good job this week. See you guys. Oh, Monday, no show. Ladies and gentlemen, Monday, no show. We will be back on Tuesday. Have a great long weekend.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid.